about India, but basically one of the points, the basic point why he called it the continent of Circe, or Circe, however you want to pronounce it, the celestial being or whatever who trapped Ulysses during one of his journeys, and she had the power to convert the people that she trapped into pigs and keep them in her sty, basically. You know, the whole thing that he was saying there about it is essentially people come from a variety of cultures and religions, etc., into India. But once they come into India, they're trapped there. They kind of, imbibe, or they are assimilated into its system so completely that they lose their identity and become, quote-unquote, Indian. And one of the things that happens there is this notion of rebirth. Now, notion of rebirth, that's why, you know, there is a certain large number of Muslims in India also believe in rebirth. Many Christians in India believe in rebirth. I mean, at least they do so in their popular kind of lives and sayings, etc., conversations. And the version of rebirth that they buy into is usually this version of reward and punishment. Now, it goes further, and you'll find that most of the Indian, so-called yogis and saints and sages also buy into this theory. And it is this variety that they buy into. And so you'll find that, you know, if somebody is going through some bad fortune, they'll be told that, don't worry, you're burning up karma. As if karma is a certain kind of a, sort of stock or store that you burn up, and therefore you become freed from the, the burden of going through that particular punishment any further. So once you arrive at a certain point, you burn up whatever you had in the past, and you end up becoming so-called free, and then you can make that discrete jump out of the original desire into that which is without desire. So that becomes the entire idea behind it. The fact is that such ideas give no credence to the soul as an evolving entity and a growing entity that is utilizing the experiences of nature to gather more power and become, in a sense, the master of its circumstances.
There is a lot, it's very easy to buy into that notion also, I think, because it appeals to you immediately, like it's very easily satisfying, that because that's what we deal with every day.
Yes, that's why it's so powerful, and that's why it has been such a powerful socializing factor in India.
But Devashishtha, a lot of times we hear phrases something like knowledge that burns up all jnanagdi dagdha karmani, that type of expression you see. Where
yes,
the fire of knowledge burning up the karma. Okay? But what is that? That means it is not as if the effects of karma, but it is essentially this. What is the meaning there? If we were to truly understand that expression, how should we understand it given this light? Under this light, what should we refer to that as?
No, there is a truth there, Siddhartha, because you see, you can understand it in two ways. One is that it is a burning up of the constituents that are bringing us these kinds of experiences, that what the Buddhists call samskaras. So one is are samskaras, which are the complexes of desire within us, are things that can be dissolved through knowledge. Now, the other is karma itself. Karma as a system of consequences, which are operating both at the vital level as well as at other levels. Now, the consequences are not necessarily moral consequences, but they are consequences. You see, what is happening is that nature and the soul are at play. And as the soul develops greater power, the laws of nature operate less and less, less on it. It becomes more and more master of these laws. To the extent that the soul is powerful enough, the laws of causation that bind the nature instruments can be dispensed with. The soul can dissolve them. The soul can be master of them. This is partly what Krishna is also saying to Arjuna when he's saying that, you know, by doing work in Karma Yoga, by doing work united with me, you will be free of all karma. He is using the news in that sense. That is, the consequences that bind people through the automatisms of nature, whether they are automatisms of material nature or of subjective nature, because there too there are automatisms, the causations that bind us will no longer bind us. That is basically the power of knowledge or the power of the soul burning karma, in the sense that it is no longer bound by these chains of causation.
I can read the next one.
Okay.
But the same solution can be elevated to a higher level of reason and given a greater plausibility and the color of a cosmic principle. For first, it may be based on the unassailable ground that all energies in nature must have their natural consequence. If any are without visible result in the present life, it may well be that the outcome is only delayed, not withheld forever. Each being reaps the harvest of his works and deeds, the returns of the action put forth by the energies of his nature, and those which are not apparent in his present birth must be held over for a subsequent existence. It is true that the result of the energies and actions of the individual may accrue not to himself, but to others when he is gone. For that we see constantly happening. It happens indeed, even during a man's lifetime, that the fruits of his energies are reaped by others. But this is because there is a solidarity and a continuity of life in nature, and the individual cannot altogether, even if he so wills, live for himself alone. But if there is a continuity of his own life by rebirth for the individual, and not only a continuity of the mass life and the cosmic life, if he has an ever-developing self, nature and experience, then it is inevitable that for him too, the working of his energies should not be cut off abruptly, but must bear this consequence at some time in his continuous and developing existence. Man's being, nature, circumstances of life are the results of his own inner and outer activities, not something fortuitous and inexplicable. He is what he has made himself. The past man was the father of the man that now is. The present man is the father of the man that will be. Each being reaps what he sows. From what he does, he profits. For what he does, he suffers. This is the law and chain of karma, of action, of the work of nature energy, and it gives a meaning to the total force of our existence, nature, character, action, which is absent from other theories of life. It is evident on this principle that a man's past and present karma must determine his future birth and its happenings and circumstances. For these two must be the fruit of his energies. All that he was and did in the past must be the creator of all that he now is and experiences in his present. Must be the creator of what he will be and experience in the future. Man is the creator of himself. He is the creator also of his fate. All this is perfectly rational and unexceptionable, so far as it goes, and the law of karma may be accepted as a fact, as part of the cosmic machinery. For it is so evident, rebirth once admitted, as to be practically indisputable.
So as Sri Aurobindo does often, he takes a certain view and refutes it and then puts it back in place. So this is what he's doing over here. He has pointed to the crudities and oversimplifications of the theory of karma, and now he's pointing to some essential truth within it and showing how there is a certain kind of, you know, power that other theories of existence have missed in the possibility of the individual and its growth, that which is the development of the individual, not only in one life, but through lives. Because if it is indeed a development of something which is eternal within us, it must take place in eternal time, or in perpetual time rather. So that perpetuity is something which spans lives, is not constrained to a single finite quantum of time, which is one life. So that's why the operation of these laws of the accumulation of consequences and of energies is something that must have a truth. He also brings in the fact that there is another side to it, which is the side of the persistence, which is not individual, but cosmic. Whatever we do in one life also has its results in nature around us, which in a form before the development of individuality ultimately persists in its own eternities, its own continuity in the mass, in the race, in the general reality of nature. So we find that whatever happens around, the posterity receives the legacy of that, of those deeds. That is, of course, what one might call cosmic karma. But along with it, at the individual level, and more so as the individual becomes a reality, more and more of a reality, this individual aspect of karma is also experienced and also becomes a project of the soul. But mind you, the way in which he has put it is all in terms of the development of the individual being. That, as he says, whatever these consequences are all accruing to this development. See, man's being, nature, circumstances of life are the result of his own inner and outer activities, not something fortuitous and inexplicable. He is what he has made himself. The past man was the father of the man that now is. The present man is the father of the man that will be. So this whole understanding of the relationship of the soul with nature as karma is one that is integral, is one that takes the entire development of the being as its, you know, trajectory from life to life.
And that way of looking at it actually gives it so much more credibility than the simple math of the previous couple of paragraphs, right?
Yes, indeed, indeed.
Devishishta,
Yes, Monica.
I just I was wondering about the action of grace then. Is it something, because somewhere in the mother he says that, that it, you have to do the inner preparation before even the grace becomes available to you. And grace does come for something quite, unlooked for. So is it something that, is it something like a culmination of what effort you might have made in the past? Or does it really prepare you for the future and what you might become in the future?
Well, we have to ask ourselves, what is grace? To a certain extent, one may say that grace is always active and everything is grace. But if we understand grace as something independent of circumstances, the act of divine will, which is transcendental and operating within nature as an intervention, then we can talk about grace as something else, which is in the Sri Aurobindo's sense. For example, the grace of, the birth of Savitri to Ashwapati, let's say, or the grace of any kind of divine intervention. Now, in a way, there is a grace that is not only constantly active in universal nature, there is also a grace that is constantly descending from above. But that too we are not conscious of and we are not receptive to because we are constrained within other laws of action. Even at the soul level, the soul is often in a condition where its commerce is with forces of universal prakriti. But not to that extent with some transcendental force that is operating from outside as an intervention. Now, that's where preparation is necessary, as you say. And in the little pamphlet, The Mother, Sri Aurobindo talks about the conditions as faith, sincerity, and aspiration. So, the building of these qualities, these are psychic qualities. The very first one itself, faith. Faith is our future orientation. Faith is that which the soul carries within itself as a certain memory of what it is to achieve, a certain power of its premonition of achievement. So that is what ultimately connects us with an intervening power, a transcendental power, not merely a cosmic power. Sincerity is that which keeps the instruments of nature in their place, open to the divine influence. Because if the nature becomes subject to error, subject to falsehood due to its own blindness, then this intervention cannot work, cannot act. An aspiration ultimately is the active power of faith. Faith activated is aspiration. So aspiration is really what calls, as he says, calls high destiny down. Therefore, that is the lever of this intervention at the level of the individual soul. So when we are talking about grace, grace is a tremendously strong power that completely overrides whatever automatisms of karma are at work as part of the soul's own growth into its own reality. So, you know, there is a place where I think Sri Aurobindo or the mother say that there are, I think the mother talks about it, that life has two paths. One is the path of accident or the way of accident, and the other is the way of grace. And people in the normal movement, even with the soul's growth, and if we forget about this moral accountant, we can call it a movement in the ways of accident. The soul is growing, but it is carried in some accident. We use the word accident, but accident we can just say is another name, a euphemism for the laws of nature. Laws of nature are, as it were, accidental to us. So this randomness in the laws of nature are, so to say, karmic. The soul is experiencing whatever is being determined by very huge complex forces in which its output is playing a part, but what is coming back to it is almost incomprehensible to it. So that law, which is the law in which we lead our lives, where we hardly know what it is that makes us deserve what we get. It is easy for us to boil it down. You know, that's another one of the kind of utilities of these laws of karma, simplified, oversimplified laws of karma. It gives a tool to the mind which explains this inexplicable universe to us. So then, from there, a leap to the law of grace is more in the nature of an inner experience, where whatever happens to us is felt by us to have a divine hand within it. Firstly, even the accidents have a divine hand. And secondly, it is a convergence of the inner and the outer, where one feels that there is a tremendous coherence to every little incident in one's life. Then there is, without doubt, the law of grace that is operating, and so-called law of karma doesn't have that appearance at all and has been overridden completely.
Thank you. Thank you. That was very nice, especially this connection between faith as a future power and aspiration and the action of grace that comes about to sort of make it happen, isn't it?
Yeah. So that whole thing is a dynamic of the soul. It's a part of the dynamic of the soul. And that dynamic of the soul is what he's pointing to over here. As ultimately, that is what he's saying, is that the whole mechanism of karma also is ultimately the development and growth of the soul. Man is creator of himself. He is the creator also of his fate. So ultimately, that indeed operating blindly through the nature instruments and through cosmic nature is what brings man's fate to him. But as the soul becomes more conscious and in possession of its instruments, it comes into its own dynamic. Its own true dynamic is no longer dependent on the laws of Prakriti. It is now dependent on the freedom of the divine will. And that transition, that transpersonal transition, is mediated by grace. At a certain point, the grace itself becomes one which reveals itself as the will of the divine into which the soul is called to take its union.
Thank you, Devashishta. Thank you so much.
Vashishtha?
Yes,
there is. I was looking at this line here and is wondering in this paragraph, and is wondering if you could elaborate on it. I just read it out. It's towards the beginning, one third. It's true that the result of the energies and actions of the individual may accrue not to himself but to others when he is gone. And in a certain sense, I can understand how in the material and vital areas, after I'm dead too, the consequences of my action will linger on amongst my family and friends. But would my aspiration, would my efforts towards a growth of consciousness, would that also have an effect on others after I'm dead? Am I interpreting this rightly? What's going on here?
Yes, Bindu. What's happening over there is that, you know, firstly, as you said, that part is absolutely true, that at the material and vital level, there is a continuation of whatever output of force or quality that you put into your environment that is bringing its own results to those who live that life within that world. But this is also true, it goes further, that there is a cosmic existence with its own cosmic aspirations. That we have an existence as an individual, but we also have an existence in various collective formations that are evolving in their own ways. Our environment has got many, and by environment I mean not only physical environment, but the environment in which we dwell has many kinds of such group evolutions within it, of which we are a part. So our aspiration as an individual is also something which is fused with a number of these other kinds of evolving aspirations, group aspirations, that in a sense we nurture, and that nurture us as individuals, and that we carry as part of the cosmic evolution. So both are happening at the same time. There is a cosmic evolution going on, that is the universal evolution, and in that cosmic evolution there's a number of other distinct evolving entities that are evolving, that are constantly progressing. Now, as individuals also, we have an independent progress that is taking place. So both these factors are impacted by the output that we make in our lives. That's what he's pointing out over here. And in both ways, both at the level of physical and vital, but also at the level of the soul, you may say the psychic entity of these group formations is receiving the impact of the karma. That's why we talk about collective karma, particularly in the Sri Aurobindo's path. Collective karma does have a reality and an importance.
Thank you very much.
Debashisda, could you expand on what you mean by collective karma? Debashisda?
Yes, Shyam.
Yeah, can you expand on what you mean by collective karma and what the importance of that would be in Sri Aurobindo's theory?
Yeah, you see, because ultimately if you kind of take this whole, you know, business about why are we here, to its logical conclusion, and as he does in the chapter preceding this, you know, the problem of, in fact, in the problem of rebirth, or sorry, the philosophy of rebirth, if you remember, he's pointing to, you know, why are we here ultimately? And he's saying we are here not merely because each individual is growing, but each individual is growing in the context of cosmos. Cosmos itself is growing. There is an evolution of cosmos of cosmic prakriti that has taken place to the point where it has prepared the instruments for Purusha to emerge. At the individual level, Purusha is emerging. And that emergence ultimately will yield the million-bodied one, what he calls the million-bodied one, which is basically that transcendental Purusha or Purushottama that is going to be at play in this world of Prakriti. Now, so both the nature instruments and the soul person have to evolve. The evolution of the person is what is taking place at the level of the individual. But the evolution of the nature formations is taking place at the level of cosmos, and its varied domain of evolution or of evolving being. Now, these varied dimensions of evolving being have to also be seen as very varied formulations of the one reality, the many ways in which the one can be talked about. See, from overmind, the differentiation of the one that takes place again both in terms of souls as well as in terms of nature. That differentiation into nature are the infinite possibilities of representing the one that nature offers. So when we are talking about our environment, not merely as a physical environment, we have to understand it in terms of the belonging of our soul. In a sense, it's investment, it's sense of identity, or its sense of acceptance of certain kinds of aspirations within cosmos. For example, you belong to a family. Your family has some inchoate aspirations within it. You may accept it, you may reject it. A sannyasi ultimately rejects the aspiration of the family. Now, you may belong to a nation. You may belong to a community. You may belong to a religion. You may belong to certain social groupings that occur in your lifetime, which have a very strong aspiration within them. Now, each one of these is a reality which ultimately develops a psychic entity within it, or a psychic entity enters into that nature formation, and it becomes an evolving formation of cosmic prakriti. Now, these are all very important, because ultimately they have to enter into dialogue with each other. Their partialities have to yield to an integrality. And that is part of the evolution of cosmic nature. We are playing a part in that. Therefore, whatever we put out into that will have its consequences in the growth of those things, as well as in the possible erosion of those things. You see, so that is why, there are both these dimensions that need to be acknowledged of the karma, the work that we put out into this world.
Beautiful, very nice, Devashishta. So when
if you look at the ultimate end, as he is pointing out in that philosophy of rebirth, ultimate end is what? Of this cycle is ultimately it is the Leela of Ananda. And the Leela of Ananda is achieved through integrality at the individual and the cosmic level. It is this plane of differentiation through the knowledge of oneness at both these levels, which is what the evolution is all about. So evolution of cosmos and evolution of individual is the preparation for a divine life on earth.
So when we say that, by extension, we mean that at some point, later rather than sooner, the personal evolution will find itself, kind of halted by, not halted, but kind of wanting for the communal or the cosmic evolution also. So, Devashishta, that in turn means that at some point, the personal evolution will find itself that in a position where it is not sufficient for the person to grow, because the person has grown much larger, so to say.
Yes, yes, undoubtedly. So there is a cosmic dimension there. That's why you can say that, you see, one individual can contain multitudes, not merely in the sense that we are a fragmented personality, but in the sense that we can grow more and more cosmic, and various types of, you know, subjective possibility can enter into our being. So from that point of view, you are absolutely right.
And when you say that these groups also have their psychic, have a psychic entity and it's growing, so at a certain level, the groups, these groups are also following in a slightly different way the same process of rebirth and growth. Would you say that?
Yes, yes, in a slightly different way, and not all of them persist. Some of them kind of get dissolved. They are subject to extinction. In that sense, the personality of these things, you see, the soul entity and the soul personality are two different things. It is only at the individual level that the soul personality develops and persists into the realization of its own eternity. But at the level of the formations, psychic entity may come into a formation, but that doesn't mean that the soul personality is ultimately going to become or realize its own eternity. It may. If it has a reality in the divine, it may. But, you know, it's a little more precarious than talking about individuals to talk about group entities that ultimately are being, sort of growing, dying, and being reborn ad infinitum.
Thank you, Devashishta. Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, okay, sure.
Sharma, do you want to read that?
Yeah.
There are, however, two riders to this first proposition, which are less general and authentic and bring in a doubtful note. For though they may be true in part, they are overstated and create a wrong perspective, because they are put forward as the whole sense of karma. The first is that, as is the nature of the energies, so must be the nature of the results. The good must bring good results, the evil must bring evil results. The second is that the master word of karma is justice, and therefore good deeds must bear the fruit of happiness and good fortune, and evil deeds must bear the fruit of sorrow, misery, and ill fortune. Since there must be a cosmic justice which is looking on and controlling in some way the immediate and visible operations of nature in life, but is not apparent to us in the facts of life as seen by us, it must be present and evident in the totality of our unseen dealings. It must be the subtle and hardly visible, but strong and firm secret thread that holds together the otherwise incoherent details of her dealings with her creatures. If it be asked why actions alone, good or bad deeds alone, should have a result, it might be conceded that good or evil thoughts, feelings, actions have all their corresponding results. But since action is the greater part of life and the test and formulated power of man's values of being, since also he is not always responsible for his thoughts and feelings, as they are often involuntary, but is or must be held responsible for what he does, as that is the subject to his choice. It is mainly his actions that construct his fate. They are the chief or the most forceful determinants of his being and his future. This is the whole law of karma.
So here again, he is trying to put in place what has been overstated, as he says, and creates a wrong perspective in the popular notion of karma. And that has to do mainly with this strict notion of good and evil and of justice that in a sense is related to a certain vital experience only. And he's pointing out that if there is a cosmic justice, then that cosmic justice must hold together not only visible things but invisible things between lives and in the whole world, in the whole cosmos. Now, that is given as the justification for this kind of good and evil theory. You see, that there is a justicer, that God is this justicer who is sitting on judgment all the time between, or the judge who is sitting on judgment all the time on lives. Those who believe in, see, this idea of life as a judgment is very strongly ingrained in the vital mind. This is the reason why those who do not believe in rebirth will ultimately invent a day of just judgment. You see, the day of judgment, which is the last day of the Judeo-Christian tradition, also rests on this whole notion of God as somebody who in some sense is meting out justice. Now, there is a notion or a truth to justice. The truth to justice is the Vedic rhythm, which ultimately is the rightness of things. Rightness of things can be thought of as proportion, can be thought of as the fact that if there is one infinite being, then to all its parts, there is the right time, place, and significance. And that must manifest in its own way. If we understand it in that sense, there can be understood also a certain kind of truth to the operation of universal law or karma as something which is related to justice. But this justice is very different from the justice of moral law in terms of individual or social understandings of good and bad. See, that justice would have more to do with the development of a consciousness which ultimately sheds its partialities of perception and arrives at integrality. So we may say that if there is a true justice which is at work in the universe and meting out consequences to individual actions, it is here to ultimately correct the system and bring it to a point where its individual components can express exactly what they need to express at the right time and place and to the right degree. That would be a true understanding of justice, but that is not easy to fathom for the mind, leave alone the vital mind. So it's easily twisted into this. On the other hand, you have the other thing that he's pointing out, which is that why should it be only actions that have this kind of, or actions in the world, in other words, what we do, which can be visible to people? Why not thoughts, feelings, etc.? And he's saying that undoubtedly thoughts, feelings, etc. must have, are also actions. They must have their effects. And those effects must also be taken into account in a theory of karma. But the reason why these external actions are given this kind of importance is because it is held that those are involuntary while these are voluntary, which ultimately is a spurious argument, because if those are involuntary, these also are involuntary. It's only to the extent that something is voluntary, whether a thought or a feeling or an action, that one can be held responsible for it in a justice sense. So there is an irony about both those particular aspects that he's presenting over here. That is that in a certain way, this is the way in which popular notions hold the significance of these things, either of justice or of the material manifested act holding its results. Because in a way, both these are related to social, sort of law, the enforcement of ethics from within a person so that it does not impact others through actions in the world.
So the origin of justice, that is the sense of justice in everyday life, as opposed to the justice that we talk of, which is a manifestation of the rhythm. Is that a function of the mental being, or is that more a function of a property of the vital being? Or is it more a combination of both?
Well, it's a combination of both. Sense of value arises in the mental being. The mind, whether we talk about it in terms of values of taste, or we talk about it in values of morality, or in talk about it in ideals, values of ideals, preferences, arises in the mind. Now, at the level of the vital, we have various tastes, for example. But these tastes are mutable. I mean, individuals may have certain tastes at a certain time. Those tastes may change to other tastes at other times. The mind comes in and gives it a certain fixed value, see, that this is good and this is bad. See, similarly, it does that with other kinds of, sort of its pet theories, the ideals that it finds to be more conducive to it, etc., to its temperament sometimes, etc., its characteristics. So the mind is what ultimately gives the sense of value to things which are otherwise senses of taste, you may say, taste and preference at the vital level. But idealism and the morality of holding things together is something which really belongs to the mind. So it is really a combination of mind and vital that is creating this particular theory of justice. Mind and vital, because the vital is the experiencer of happy or unhappy results or consequences. The rewards and punishments belong to the vital, but the principle on which reward and punishment is to be meted out belongs to the mental. The valuation of good and bad belongs to the mental. The experience belongs to the vital. So it's really a combination of the two, and this combination really belongs to the lower fringe of our social existence.
Very nice, Debashishda. So this means that if a particular person has gone far enough to be able to separate out these parts clearly, then such a person would be able to see the different components combining together to create this sense of morality or ethics or justice. Is that correct?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. One would be able to see what is at the basis of our notion of justice, and then might even be able to see that this notion of justice is in some way arbitrary. That in a real sense, idea of justice is much more profound and has to do with the manifestation of the One.
Which is that typically concept of law is associated with justice, right? So in this case, let us say a law is there sometimes to explain certain reality or certain way of operating things. So in this case, we're talking about law of karma. So as long as we are operating, as long as you don't get to the integrality at which the law operating to that extent, whether it is whether you accept it or not, it will work the way your understanding is. Is it right? That's the way. So as long as you stay in the ignorance, and there will be always a consequence to each of the actions.
Technically, yes, Sita, but you see, there is another factor here, which is that arrival at an integral consciousness is only an end result of this journey at understanding justice, if you want to call it that. But even before arriving at an integral consciousness, one may unite with the will of the divine. This is really the lesson of the Gita. When Krishna is saying to Arjuna, surrender to me completely and I will act through you. You will be the occasion only. And in this action, I will deliver you from sin and evil. What does he mean? Because he's using the term, sin over there. Now, what has loosely been translated? What does he mean, or evil? He means basically this distortion, but that is the karma. The karma is ultimately the so-called residue of karma. The so-called result that we are experiencing is arising because A, oneness is not experienced. I am doing to others, right? That's why Confucius is going to end up saying, do not do to others what you would not have them do to you, is the primary law of ethics. Of course, this is also very problematic, because I may be perfectly all right with somebody doing something to me, which maybe somebody else might find very harmful if done to them. There is a relativity at work there that is not sufficiently accounted for. But the truth behind all these things is the experience of oneness first. If oneness is experienced, you are not doing anything to anybody else but to yourself. Secondly, you are in tune with the one consciousness which is at work in the world, what Sri Aurobindo calls the active Brahman. Now, even before that, one might actually surrender oneself completely to the divine to the extent that one becomes open and aware of the divine will acting in one, to the extent that the ego has erased itself before the divine will. There is the possibility of embodying in one's actions that law of truth, the rhythm, so that in one's actions at least, one is not deforming or marginally deforming that truth. Out of that may come greater and greater purification of that experience and ultimately union of consciousness and knowledge of integrality. But that can be a step in that direction. So the growth or progress of surrender to the divine will and ultimately the knowledge of the divine consciousness is what is the safeguard against this consequences of justice that is being talked about.
Thank you. So as long as some kind of duality is there, there is that concept of justice.
Yes, undoubtedly.
As to the discussion of feelings and thoughts, they are as much actions as the material manifest actions. That is also another thing he is saying, right?
Yes, yes. They are as much actions. But there is something to be said over there. There is something interesting there, which is that in the scale of manifestation, in the scale of material manifestation, it is only when physical actions or actions in the material world or in the through the material body are done that there is a certain kind of materialization that takes place that in a sense leaves traces in the material world. You see, so something is there to be said about it. So for example, though it is true that if you have a bad thought, it will immediately go out into the mental world or into the mental sphere and begin having its effects. And those effects will also come back to you. That thing that he is saying, there is no doubt about that. But this is also true that at the various levels, from an inner to an outer manifestation, if there are checks and balances, to that extent, something may be prevented from actually having effect on a much wider scale than if it is only in the inner worlds. If something, for example, is spoken which has been thought about, that thought may not enter certain people due to lack of receptivity, but immediately it enters into those minds because the physical receives them. If something is written, not only does it enter into the minds of those who are present, but it enters into all time at the material level. So in that sense, materialized acts have a greater power in the material world in creating karma or karmic effects here than thoughts, feelings, etc. Though in truth, all these things are acts or actions or can be called karma. I bring up this issue because the mother has talked about it in terms of materialization, that, you know, we can have a part to play in this. She said, you know, hostility, anger, etc. may, you know, not may, I mean, so long as we are not master of ourselves. But to the extent that the Purusha emerges, it can observe these things and bring them under its control. And even the physical being may have a part to play in independently preventing these things from coming out. See, that they can be controlled from within. First, to observe them within may have a very strong, power in not materializing them. But also, at the physical level, to be able to actually sort of develop independent habits of, manifestation are an aid towards the extension of karma, to what extent it goes, you see. So, for example, she gives you, even for children, lessons such as, if you feel angry, put your fist into your pocket, don't go around beating somebody up, you see. So these are very simple. Just a moment, I think Subhashita has got cut off. Hello? Hello?
Yeah, we are just adding him, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, so basically that's just a point to be noted in this discussion.
Mother also said every thought has as much a life as you. Every thought has a life of its own. Right?
Yeah, very true, very true. In fact, it's the mother who has made this point much more strongly, that thoughts, feelings, etc., as much actions as, our physical movements, etc. So both these things are true.
In a way, the world is, we are in somebody else's thought, right? That is,
yes.
The whole creation is, we ourselves are thought of someone.
So. Yes, very true.
And I remember one of the letters of Sri Aurobindo telling somebody that, encouraging him or her to write or to articulate the problem clearly to him and the mother, and him saying that clear articulation of the problem itself has the way to solving it.
Yes. I haven't read that, but I can believe that, yes. I think we can stop today over here. Now, one thing is that I see that next Friday is the 13th. Friday the 13th, rather auspicious day. But actually, that 12th and 13th, both 12th and 13th, I won't be available. 13th, I'm flying out. And 12th, I have a conference here in Calcutta. So we'll have to skip a week. We'll skip a week and come back to our study, and I think, can we keep it from now on Thursday evenings?
Yes, Devashishtha, we can keep it on Thursday.
Okay. So, we'll move to the Thursday evening, US Pacific Standard Time, 7:30 p.m. 19th is what it's going to be, will be our next meeting. And for people in India, it will be the 20th morning.
Why did we change it to Thursday? Did I miss something?
We changed it to Thursday because at least one person, Subhashita, could not attend on Wednesdays. So I asked everybody whether both the days being equal, Thursday was a possibility, and that's how we arrived at that day.
Oh, man, Wednesday works better for me. But it's okay. Thursday's been decided, then I'll
can discuss this later. We'll discuss this in sort of by email, maybe, and let's see if something can be done. Okay.
So shall we finish with the meditation now?
Yes, why not?